Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovix, and joining me today is Lobo Tigre. He's the author and publisher of the IndependentSpeculator.com. How are you today, Lobo?
I'm very well, Tom, and happy to be back with Palisade.
We're very happy to have you back. I thought we could start by going over one of the last articles that you've written on your site and posted on Twitter about the Robinhood traders and the risks of chasing momentum right now. We're seeing a lot of people kind of jump into the bear rally, or if you want to call it the dead cat bounce in equities. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
All right. Well, this is much in the headlines, so it's not original to me to point out, you know, the excitement over the so-called Robin Hooders. It is interesting, though, to me that, you know, throughout my career at Casey Research, the marketing guys were always saying, don't bother with young people. Young people don't invest. They're not interested in investment services and products. And I always thought there was an opportunity there. And boy, this thing has really shown that young people do invest, you know, given the appropriate incentives and opportunities. They are interested. The thesis of the article is really not just that, oh, this is crazy or exciting or wild or all these things. It is, and there's wild stuff in there. But the thesis of the article is actually that this could be a very constructive thing. As I was just saying, you know, marketing to younger people before was considered a dead end. So for people like you and me, this is great to have a new audience. But on top of that, I think of it as potentially a democratization of the markets here. This is I'm getting to the punchline instead of the meat of the article here. But I think this is potentially very important. You have, I think, a dangerous situation in society with the 99% versus the 1% and all this politics of envy out there. It's potentially very, very destructive. So to the degree that you allow anybody to invest and that anybody thinks they can and can succeed in the marketplace is potentially a game changer. You don't have to be some Wall Street fat cat to invest anymore. The revolution that Robinhood brought to the table was zero commission trading. And yes, they do make their money on margin trades, and you know, it's a normal business. But they forced the mainstream brokers to offer zero commission trading. You know, many of them have gone to no fees on ordinary trades. So this has made it possible for, you know, even your pizza delivery guy or whoever to start investing in the market. And they also have offered fractional share purchases. So if you like Tesla, but it's, you know, $1,000 a share or whatever crazy price it is, you know, you can buy a tenth of a Tesla share, which is much more affordable for you than it would be to just buy Tesla. So you may think, oh, I'm beating up on Robin Hood and you know, joining the bandwagon, because a lot of people snort, you know, they see Robin Hood, oh, those Robin Hooders and their FANG stocks or whatever. It's very dismissive, the attitude about Robin Hood. And I'm actually proposing that this could be a very good thing for all of us, because it starts erasing the line between the 99% and the 1%. And getting rid of us versus them thinking, I think, is healthy for any society.
I couldn't agree more. It's interesting to try and think about the emergence of young people, let's say millennials, getting into this industry and being interested in investing. I think the cryptos would have been a great example of that. I was reading another article on your Twitter feed about bringing to the consciousness of that type of investor gold and silver and some of these resource stocks. And do you think that the fundamentals of that industry are going to start seeping into that crowd?
Yes, actually I do. And I'm a bit more contrarian in saying that. It's a thesis I've had for a while, and I'm still waiting to be right. You know, maybe now with this piling into the marketplace of younger people, maybe I will be. We'll see. I'm not promising that. But the idea there is that because the Bitcoin craze really got the attention of a lot of young people, I think that was perhaps the, you know, the wedge in the door. You know, before Robinhood, this Bitcoin craze really got a lot of young people excited, and they saw that their peers, not just rich old guys on Wall Street, but their peers were suddenly millionaires or, you know, making a lot of money, or at least in theory making a lot of money with the Bitcoin rally in 2017. And, you know, that's great. I miss that, frankly. I didn't believe, I'm not hostile to cryptos. In fact, I see them as a market response to the government monopoly on money. And I like it. But I just couldn't see something that actually doesn't have any real world value, you know, going up and justifying a particular price. So I missed that. I did. But these young people that got on board and they saw this, they got excited and great. Okay, you go 20-1 in 2017, it corrects, and, you know, maybe it goes back up again. The hodlers are hoping it will, but it's been 3 years and everybody else has to be wondering, well, okay, what's next? Where's the next Bitcoin? And this is my thesis, is okay, maybe, you know, Bitcoin going from dollars to $20,000 is a once in a lifetime event, or the 20 time gain in 2017 is a once in a lifetime event in that space. But you and I and our audience knows that in the resource sector, 10 baggers, 20 baggers, those, you know, they don't happen every day, but there's usually at least one of those or more every year. And it is a regular occurrence in the resource space. So if I'm a recent crypto millionaire and I'm looking for the next Bitcoin, and I see that gold might be going into one of its big rallies, you know, I'd be a fool to dismiss that because, oh, that's, you know, gold is for old people or whatever. And I was specifically, when I wrote that, taking on the drop gold campaign that some of the crypto guys put together. I think any smart investor or speculator, young or old, is going to look for opportunity. And it's not about gold being better than Bitcoin or the reverse. It's about where is the opportunity now?
Absolutely. I think one of the positives from the Robinhood traders is hopefully start to educate some of those investors, to expose them to maybe value and the fact that there are many 10 to 20 baggers in this space. That kind of leads me to something we were talking about before the call, about your pre-production sweet spot. And maybe tell us a little bit about how you evaluate a company at that point and what kind of potential we can see gain-wise out of a company like that.
Okay, good segue. But before we go there, I want to say one more thing about the younger people on Robinhood. I'm not dismissing the dangers of chasing momentum. In fact, the article that you mentioned about the Robinhooders actually sprang to my mind after I wrote one about the dangers of chasing momentum. And both of these articles are at the top of our homepage, by the way, for the audience at independentspeculator.com. These are recent articles, so you can find both of these. But obviously, momentum chasing has lots of dangers, and people, you know, there are frankly irresponsible people out there in the Robin Hood space, you know, literally like the joke saying buy, buy, buy. There's a guy, you know, Davey Day Trader, who actually told his Twitter audience that you could collect random letters to put together a ticker symbol and just buy, 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 because everything goes up a bazil, was his phrase. There's a link to that in the article, and I don't want to beat up too much on Davey Day Trader, but our audience may recognize his name as being the guy who said he was a better investor than Warren Buffett. And he was citing his gains since the crash of March. And on that basis, the statement may be accurate. But there's a really interesting point here, and to tie this sort of up with a bow, is that I saw him interviewed on CNBC, and the interviewer asked him, so, yeah, but do you think over decades you'll be having a track record like Warren Buffett? And he said, oh, no, after coronavirus, I'm going back to my day job. So I thought that was really telling. You know, he may actually be much more clever than he comes across. He knows that what's happening now is not sustainable. And even what he's doing now, he doesn't believe that you can do that forever. It's a market aberration where with the Fed throwing all this money at the marketplace, and this matters, right? This is happening now. It's almost like you could pick Scrabble letters and just buy, buy, buy. I think that's important to be aware that there are actual problems here. I mean, there was a story the other day about a kid who committed suicide because suddenly he saw Robinhood telling him he owed over $700,000. This is not funny stuff, and the lessons learned hopefully will be very important. And I hope that they will result in a democratization of investment. I think that'd be a good thing. So I just wanted to put that in there. I don't want to dismiss the dark side of what we were talking about earlier. It's real. And hopefully it will have a positive educational outcome to the benefit of us all. So, sorry, do you want to say something before I talk about the pre-production sweet spot?
I was just going to add that, as you say, it seems very telling of Davey Day Trader that he's going to be going back to his day job. Because if he's making a bazil, as he says, then what would be the point of having to go back to a day job?
That was my first thought. If you look at his YouTube feed, the headline's like, I made $500,000 today. I lost $500,000 today. it's up and down all over the place. So yeah, let's not beat that one to death. But I do think that's important to understand. And it's striking to me that, you know, maybe even he knows that, you know, his current run of luck is not sustainable any more than, you know, a lucky gambler in Vegas at the roulette wheel.
Absolutely.
All right. So the pre-production sweet spot, I'm glad you brought that up. It's something we should probably specify. Back in my Casey research days, oddly enough, thinking of Bitcoin in 2017, that was about the time that I came up with this idea. And the idea is that it's long been known that there is a re-rating of companies when they go from being an explorer to being a producer. Now, this is not the case if you're an existing producer and you build a new mine. But if you have no mines, you make a significant discovery, and you build your first mine, you're a different company after that process. And the market typically re-rates that. And this was long known. I didn't invent the pre-production sweet spot. It was long known as that. But there was never really a sense that it was a particularly lucrative investment opportunity, because everybody can see who's building a mine. There's no secret who's building a mine. There's no special sauce there, if you will. And so the presumption was, and what my elders taught me when I first came into this business 16 years ago, is that, yeah, it's, you know, this is a pre-production sweet spot, but it's only there for modest gains. It's priced in because everybody can see it coming. And this is it's so well known that it's part of what is known as the Lassonde curve, which is that famous chart that you've seen, the life cycle of an explorer, where they go and the share price spikes on the discovery, and then you go into the boring engineering phase, as Doug would call it, or the orphan phase, as I've seen it called, when you have all this technical work. And then the share price curves back up again as you build that mine. What my insight was, or my stroke of luck perhaps was, it occurred to me, I've seen that chart so many times, I'd never seen a number on it. I'd never seen, well, what is that gain in that typical boring engineering phase to the transition to a producer? What is the re-rate? And I asked around, and nobody I asked knew. I asked Doug Casey, and he's like, well, maybe 20%. You know, that's nice, but it's you know, not the 10 baggers or even doubles and triples that most speculators are hoping for. So I realized that nobody really knew. And so we started digging into that. And, you know, my team collected stories from, you know, old editions of the Northern Miner, my own memory, Doug's memory. We collected stories of first time mine builders. And the guys came back to me. The first number they came back was something on the order of 145%, if memory serves, between a construction decision and first pour. And I said, no, that can't be, you know, go do it again. Find some more examples. It was only 20 odd examples at that first pass. It's like, no, that can't be right. So the boys went back, did some more research, came back with 40 or 50 examples, and it was less, but it was still on the order of 120%, 115%. This was a while ago now, so I don't remember the precise numbers. And out of respect for my former employer's copyright, I've actually deleted all my old Casey files. I don't have access to my old work with them. But I remember it was still just gobsmacking number, like, wow. And we researched some more, and we came up with a number, I think, that we ended up publishing for the first time, was something like 110% gains from a construction decision to that first production. And I remember telling Doug about that. He was just floored. He couldn't believe it. And, you know, I showed him the math, and like, wow. And my favorite part of this story is that I told Rick the same thing, Rick Rule, that is. I told all my seniors, my mentors in the past, right, because I didn't want to publish this this really sort of game-changing number, and then have somebody more experienced come along and say, no, that's wrong, and this is why, right? So I told my mentors, and Rick says, well, that's really interesting. Let me take this to my boys and have them research it, and I'll tell you what we come up with. And a few weeks later, his response was, we could find no flaw. And I thought that, coming from Rick Rule, that was actually a very high compliment. We could find no flaw.
Absolutely.
And furthermore, I mean, if you know Rick, you know, he's not one who goes around, you know, praising rainbows and sunshine all over everybody. So not only that, but he said that they were forming an investment thesis within their portfolio management based on this research, based on the fact that the gain in the pre-production sweet spot was actually much sweeter than anybody had really realized. And in the years since I published this research, and now I've redone it, now that I'm, you know, independent and running my own show, I've redone the research, I've expanded on it. And every time the number fluctuates a bit, it usually comes down a bit, but it's still holding steady around 100%. Now, 100%, as I said before, is not the 10-bagger many speculators are hoping for. But the real kicker is that most people who set out to build their mine do build their mine. Like, the number is something like 95% of the companies that set out to build their first mine actually succeed. And if you look at the success, and we can get a little bit in the weeds here with the various numbers and so on, not all of them succeed. Not all of them actually deliver positive gains. It is possible to lose money on a pre-production sweet spot play. But overall, the average from the successes there is still around 100%. And in my mind, the very best thing is that the average is still positive. Even in a bear market, it's much less, like 20-30%, but it's still there. And if you could only pick them in a bull market, it goes back up to closer to that 150%. It's really extraordinary, and there are a lot of numbers and statistics that I could cite here, but I encourage everybody to look on our website. The pre-production sweet spot is what you're looking for. There's a search tool there, or send me an email. I'll send you a link so you can download my report on this, which is available for free, by the way. And it's just extraordinary. It was a big shock to me when I discovered it. It's a central part of my own investment thesis now. I have several pre-production sweet spot plays in my portfolio. If you look at my published track record, there's a link at the bottom of all of our web pages to the track record. You can see that several of my bigger wins in recent years have been pre-production sweet spot stories. And it's a thesis that has worked for me, and it's something that I am putting to work going forward.
Lobo, that reminds me of how do you look at that? Seems to be, let's say, one leg of the stool on increasing your leverage in your exposure to some of these companies. So what are some of the other ways that you can increase your leverage to really maximize your gains like that?
Sure. I have several answers for that. But before we move on from the pre-production sweet spot, I think it's worth stressing that the pre-production sweet spot, or PPSS as I call it, it's in my mind the best reward for risk. And if you remember what I said, like 95% of the companies succeeded at building their mines. I think about 70% of the companies in the database produce positive gains. So this is not 10-bagger hunting ground. Some of the very best stories produced on that level, gains on that level. But it, generally speaking, is not the highest leverage, which is what you're asking about now. It's the highest certainty for substantial gains, if you understand the distinction I'm making. I'm not promising that the PPSS is going to deliver your biggest wins. What I am saying is that it's much less risky, right? You have substantial wins for much less risk, and that's why it's a central part of my current MO. Now, to increase leverage, there are several general ideas, but I want to focus on two that I think are very relevant to the market today, and that's takeovers and private placements. And we can tease those apart. I think most of the audience probably knows something about both of these ideas, but you tell me, where do we want to go first?
Well, why don't we start with the takeovers? Again, you wrote a great article on another one of your let's say, parts of your thesis of the takeover tsunami. And there's three kind of main qualifiers to that thesis. So why don't we start there?
Sure. Well, as far as the thesis goes, the idea is, well, one, we've seen major takeovers at the top of the food chain, right? We had the Barrick and Randgold, you had Newmont and Goldcorp. So this consolidated at the very top of the gold space. And for a while, that had a negative effect on takeovers, as those two big players were really rationalizing their new portfolios, divesting assets rather than acquiring. There was a dearth of takeovers. They have worked their way through that now to some degree. And so there's potentially a resurgence of takeovers at the top of the food chain again, which is part of the story. But the other thing is that, you know, that's just at the top. You still have your mid-tiers and all these others that have to replace the assets that the ounces that they mine. And there's been a huge lack of exploration for years. When you have a market downturn, and really, even though gold and silver have recovered now in over the last year significantly, we started this huge downslide in 2012. And yeah, gold had a rally in 2016, but it fizzled so hard. A lot of people saw that as a head fake and didn't buy back into gold and didn't put more money in this space, even when it started rallying last year. So there's been a more than decade-long dearth of exploration. And that means that there's not a lot of great projects with profitable ounces around. And so meanwhile, you're mining. And every ounce that you mine is one less ounce you have on your books. And if you keep doing that without adding ounces, you mine yourself out of business. So that's sort of the second portion here, is that we have this structural situation where producers need to either discover, which you can't do with the snap of a fingers, or buy. And given the lack of exploration, they're going to buy. The other part, which is topical to right now, is with all the COVID-19 shutdowns, we have a specific time-sensitive impact here. Where, you know, if you're a producer, especially if you're a producer in a place like, say, Mexico, where they shut everything down, have to stop all your work, but you can't stop paying your employees. Mexico's not going to let you stop paying your miners. Oh, no, you got to keep paying all those guys to do nothing. So you're in a situation where your cash flow has dropped to almost nothing and your expenses haven't changed. So you got to cut something. What are you going to do? You're going to cut exploration. It's a more acute version of the general problem of lower prices resulting in less exploration. So all these three things come together now to a situation where the miners, as we reopen again, and particularly if you're in the gold space where gold prices now are holding above 1700 for months, you know, that's an extremely attractive price environment for the producers. But at the same time, you know, they've been forced to shut down or have extra expenses of, you know, shutting down but not being able to cut their employment. So no exploration. All of this, in my mind, makes this a very good time to look into takeovers. You know, everybody knows takeovers produce when a larger company buys the target company, they have to offer a premium usually to get shareholders to go along with it. And that premium can be anywhere from 20-30% to 50% or even 100% premiums. And, you know, that means the stock price of the target can leap 50 or 100% when this offer is made. So everybody knows that this is possible. What I'm saying is this is the year to look for this. This is the year to position yourself. This is the year to look at the smaller companies that have assets that make for a good takeover. And of course, I have an essay on that too. There's content on the takeovers on the website where you can see what makes for a good takeover target. And that's for free, by the way.
So let's move on to private placements then.
Okay. So this is another thing where in general, people know that private placements are how companies raise money. You know, if you're a going concern, you make shoes, or you're a miner, you're expected to pay for your costs in general out of your operating profits. But if you're an explorer, you have no operating profits. All you do is pour money into holes in the ground and hope to get lucky. So you have to raise more money generally by issuing more shares. Debt for exploration, by the way, does happen sometimes, but in my mind, that's a red flag. You have no income. Taking on debt, hoping to get lucky in your exploration, is a recipe for unhappy shareholder outcomes, in my view. So the general means is these private placements. It's like an IPO, except it's not I, it's just a PO, but it's off the market. So that's why they call it a private placement. You're not listing new shares on the market. You're selling new shares to individual investors who generally have to be SEC accredited in the US and Canada. Now, why is this an opportunity? Well, because sort of like with the takeovers, the takeover company has to offer a premium to the company being bought to get shareholders to go along with it. If you issue a private placement, you have to offer the investor some incentive to go along with that. By the way, the private placements come with a 4-month trading halt or hold in Canada and a 12-month hold in the US. So if I buy into a private placement and I can't sell my stock and the company goes down, I'm in trouble. So I really need an incentive to participate in this private placement. Usually that comes in the form of the private placement consisting of units that are offered below market prices, and the units have a share in there and a warrant for buying a share in the future. It's like a warrant that you have a right but not an obligation to buy another share at a set price for a certain amount of time. And that warrant can be very juicy. You know, if you've got a company, say, trading at a dollar, they issue a private placement, say, 90 cents or 80 cents to, and it has a warrant, which is good for 2 years at $1.50, and the company is successful. Well, A, you bought shares at the 90 or 80 cents, so you have a win there. But let's say the stock goes up to $2. Well, now your warrants, which are at 150, that's a guaranteed win. You can exercise the warrant for 150, sell the new shares for $2, and you have a guaranteed win. So the warrants are extremely attractive. Well, that's all great, you may say, Lobo, but that's only available to accredited investors. You know, what about the rest of us? Well, here's the thing. If the company offers this private placement below market, everybody who's in the stock and is an accredited investor and wants a piece of this juicy private placement, a lot of those people will actually sell the stock, and they don't even care what price they sell at as long as it's above the price of the offering, so they can buy into the offering and get the warrant. So you'll often see an announcement of a private placement whack the share price. And that's an opportunity for everybody else. If you think the stock's going to go up anyway, and suddenly you can get it for 10 or 20% less, you know, that adds leverage to your upside going forward. So this is something to watch for. And as far as why is this important now, sort of like with the takeover thesis, we've had this dearth of exploration for so long. And you don't go fishing in the desert, right? You don't try to raise money when the markets are down and everybody's off chasing Bitcoin or pot stocks or whatever other fad of the day it is. Now we have investment increasing in the gold space. You have the gold price having reached and stayed at a level where even generalist investors are starting to get excited about it. And money is flowing back. We can see this in the M&A activity. We can see this in the private placement activity. I have seen, just in the companies I follow from my readers, an uptick in private placement opportunities. And of course, I send out an alert to subscribers of the Independent Speculator when I see one I like. But that's just happening in my little sector of the market. The broader market is seeing this return of money, which, by the way, whether you participate in a private placement or whether you buy on the dip because of the private placement, as I'm suggesting, is an opportunity. Just the fact that money is returning to the gold and silver space is by itself a very bullish thing. So there's sort of three different ways this private placement thing is an opportunity. And I think it specifically says something about our market right now. It's something that people can look for. Put it on your radar. Watch for something. If there's a company you like, and you can go to SADAR or look at their own publications to see how much money they have, and it's obvious they're going to need more money. If they have a few $100,000 in the bank and they want to do a major drill campaign this year, they're going to need a couple $1 million. So the smart thing to do is to watch for the private placement. You may, if you're accredited, be able to participate and benefit from the warrants. But even if you're not, you can get that low entry point and get in on the cheap.
two questions from that. Sometimes the actual warrants are listed and you can buy them at a discount to the actual shares, correct?
Yeah, that's a great point, Tom. If it's not always the case, and many times the warrants are non-transferable, but management really wants to reward the investors that buy into the company and not make it a free-for-all. But other times you've got a bigger company, you know, and it's a lot of warrants, and it doesn't really affect them that much. So they'll make the warrants transferable. And when that happens, sometimes the warrant gets its own listing. And you can buy the warrant and you can trade it on the market the same way you would trade a stock. The thing to remember is that the warrants, when you buy them on the market, they will be at a discount to the share price. But that discount, it's there for a reason, and actually two reasons. One is the warrant can expire, whereas the stock doesn't. If you buy the stock and it takes the company several years to deliver, but you hold, you eventually win. If you buy the warrant and it's going to expire in 6 months, right? It's been out there already for whatever months and it's going to expire in 6 months, and the stock doesn't deliver in that time period, you lose everything. So that's one reason for the discount. The other thing is that the warrant, in my previous example, the warrant was at $1.50, and the stock was at $2 in my example. So you might see that warrant trade for something like 50 cents or less because of the timing risk on it. Because not only do you have to pay somebody to give you that warrant, you also have to pay the $1.50 to exercise the warrant. So if the shares are trading at $2, then arguably the value between the $1.50 and the $2 exercise price is that 50 cents. And how much of that you discount is what the seller is going to be offering. And how soon the warrant expires has a lot to do with the discount there. So it's a little bit more complicated than just looking at the price of the warrant. You at the very least have to add to it the price you would have to exercise, and then consider, what's my risk here? How much of a discount would I want? How much time is there left in this warrant? But the important thing, and I'm really glad you brought this up, is that if you're not an accredited investor and you can't get in on the private placement in the first place, the secondary market for these warrants gives you an opportunity to get exposure through the warrants that you wouldn't have otherwise.
Great clarification there, Lobo. The other part of that I was wondering about is that I know in Canada we have the 4-month lockup on the shares, as you were saying, but I was wondering if that recently changed in the US, because I know that we've previously seen 6-month holds on US stocks, and you were saying that they're now 12 months?
No, that might be old information. I was told, and the last I knew, it was 12 months. If it's down to 6 months, that's great. And by the way, if you go through the paperwork, and it's complicated, and you have to deal with your broker, a broker who knows how to deal with this can file paperwork and get your hold reduced to 4 months. At least it used to be the case. So I would say to be determined. This is something for investors to be aware of, is that typically the hold period is longer in the U.S., but it can be mitigated if you have an experienced broker in that area.
I think that was a great clarification on the private placement space. As we're talking about all of the ways to gain more leverage into these investments, it makes me think about silver as opposed to gold, and how we've seen recently one of the all-time highs for the silver to gold ratio. So in your opinion, Lobo, how are you seeing the silver space develop, and do you see that same leverage inherent in that market versus the gold market?
Sure. I have maybe good news and bad news here. Silver bugs, and I am a silver bug, but a lot of very diehard silver bugs, they love me and hate me because I really have no use for the gold-silver ratio. It has, in my experience, zero predictive power. And yes, if it gets very extreme, it's logical to think that it would tend to revert to the mean or median. But that doesn't tell you which price is going to go up. If the gold-silver ratio is extreme, it can become less extreme by gold coming down rather than silver going up. It doesn't tell me what to buy. It doesn't help me. All it does is say, wow, this is out of whack. Great, I knew that already.
Great point.
So, that said, you know, I get hate mail every time I say that, but I think it's true. I just can't pretend otherwise. That said, I am very bullish on silver, and I do think it's unlikely that gold will come down this time. The fundamentals are very, very bullish. Why would I think that gold's going to come down to, I mean, heck, it would have to come down like 50% in order to have the gold-silver ratio go back to some semblance of reasonability. So I don't see that happening. Yeah, I'm bullish on silver. I think, though, and I'm glad you asked this because I think this is very topical for this year. Not just I think. The data is also that silver tends to lag gold. Right? We've seen this in all the big gold rallies since 1970, really. You see gold take off first. You see silver lag. And then eventually, silver not only catches up on a percentage gain basis, it surpasses gold. From trough to peak, the gains in a silver bull, all the big ones that I've seen, the gains for silver are higher than for gold. It just, like, once silver gets going, a fire is under that rocket and it just takes off. So that's great. And it's doubly great right now because silver is still relatively quite cheap. Gold is knocking on the door of 1800 and then on to all-time highs. Silver, people are celebrating because it's 17, 18 bucks. That's still very cheap. It's nowhere near all-time highs. You know, gold only has to go up 150 bucks or so to hit a new nominal all-time high, not inflation adjusted. Silver has to more than double. It's kind of funny. Now I didn't think about it. I had a guy on Twitter say he was disagreeing with me for being so bullish on gold because silver has the potential to double and gold does not. And my reply was, I disagree. I think gold does have the potential to double from here. Given all the crazy stuff governments are doing, all the money printing and zero to negative interest rates, all this stuff is extremely bullish for gold. I'm not saying it will double, but I absolutely could see it doubling. My difference with you, sir, is that I think silver could quadruple easily or more. So I'm not a silver bear. And the punchline here, the important thing, all this arm waving about how great silver is, anybody can say that. But I think what's really important is this lag and that we're still in that lag. And so, yes, I'm very bullish on gold. And yes, I'm very bullish on silver. But silver is the better bargain right now. And so it's absolutely a high priority for me as I look to what to add to my portfolio to look for great silver speculations.
Excellent information there, Lobo. As I know, some of our listeners will be disappointed if I don't touch on this topic, but you know a lot about the uranium market. So is there anything kind of new other than we've seen, you know, the quote unquote perfect storm develop for supply and demand seems to be coming back up? Is there anything that you'd like to kind of bring to the forefront on that front?
Yeah, there are several points. And again, there are in the Independent Speculator website, there's my paid services, which I hope will interest everybody, of course. But there's a lot of free content and it covers pretty much everything you and I have discussed so far, and also uranium. So I do encourage people to come. We have, in case you missed something, I have a free weekly digest, and I promise I don't spam readers. You get one email per week, and that's it. And all of the stuff we're talking about, you can find out more that way, including recent coverage on uranium. And I think the salient points on this are, one, I didn't know. I don't read Kazakhstan's internal coverage and Kazatomprom's coverage all time because I don't cover the bigger companies very often. So I admit that this one kind of snuck by me until one of my astute readers pointed it out. I didn't realize earlier that Kazatomprom has stopped buying on the spot market, and they have, you know, they have now said that they are not buying on the spot market. They are fulfilling into their longer term contracts. Not only that, they may even have to buy, according to the CEO. Kazatomprom is the world's largest single producer and its lowest cost producer. So for these guys to say they're not selling into the spot market and may actually have to buy in the spot market to fulfill some of their contracts, this is a big deal. This is a game-changing input to the whole equation. Now, on top of that, again, this is very topical to right now. We have this whole COVID situation. And what's really interesting about that is that you had Canada's Cameco, another of the world's big producers, they had already shut down their number two mine, the MacArthur River operation, last year. This year, in response to the COVID situation, they shut down their number one mine, Cigar Lake, which all by itself supplies about 13% of the annual mine supply. So it's a huge operation and a hugely impactful operation. And they shut that down supposedly because of the COVID-19 shutdown situations. But now that the COVID-19 situation is opening up again, they haven't reopened the mine. And they have, Cameco, that is, they have said that they are still indeterminate about when they're going to reopen the mine. So this tells me that, you know, maybe I'm a little suspicious here. This is just me speculating, perhaps, on what the – but the company is saying, oh, it's still indeterminate. But if they had good reason to open back up again, they would. I think they're really keeping it shut because of low prices. Why should they deplete their flagship asset at prices that still make no sense when they can buy uranium on the spot market like Kazatomprom and sell it into higher priced long-term contracts, right? It makes no sense to deplete your asset. If you're already in production and there's cost to shutting it down and going on care and maintenance, then I can see why you would keep producing even if it's not so profitable. But when you have shut down and it costs you money to restart again, you know, why deplete the asset when you could just spend less to keep it on care and maintenance and hopefully bring it back online when prices increase again? I think both of these are very, very powerful and specific inputs to this year's equation. And there has been some bearishness pushback on this, particularly from people say, oh, well, you know, the COVID shutdowns are ending and the uranium supply is going to come back online. Well, none of these guys have announced that they're bringing their production back online. I understand that some other producers have, but these big players have not. And even if they did, you still have a couple months of shutdown. So whatever the mine supply was going to be for 2020, it's not going to be now. Even if they start tomorrow at Cigar Lake, which they can't, by the way, it takes time to take a mine off care and maintenance and put it back into production. Even the in-situ recovery operations in Kazakhstan, you'd say, oh, it's just pumping fluids. They can turn that on with a switch. Well, yes and no. There's work to be done. So it takes time to go back into production. So even if they announce today that they're going to do that, it will still be a while before that production comes back. And it will never make up for the production that hasn't been delivered this year. So 2020 is already, I think, baked in the cake, going to deliver less mine supply than previously anticipated. And I think that has consequences for the price going forward.
Couldn't agree with you more, Lobo. Maybe before we wrap up, there's one thing that we were talking about before the call about why you're not investing in industrial metals like copper and nickel right now. So maybe explain to us a little bit about that.
Sure. And that's an important question because I've come out as a big bull for the minerals that are essential to the new energy paradigm, right? You know, and I'm not just talking Tesla, the whole thing. And this includes, by the way, the solar panels, not just the batteries. So it's not just battery metals. And it's not even just metals. But I'm very bullish on this whole thing. The world is going in this direction. The world wants to go in this direction. People are buying Teslas even without government subsidies. And I think there are some people who are resistant to how big and important this trend is. And I want to say, for whatever it's worth, I believe in it. I believe the world is going in this direction. And maybe the internal combustion engine is still a better technology. Doesn't matter. The market has spoken. The market is going in this direction. And certainly the more younger people, millennials and so on, start buying more cars and things, this looks to me like an actual paradigm shift, a one-way street where the key minerals that are necessary to power this revolution will benefit. Now, note, I'm not just saying everything. It's key minerals. Some of them, like lithium, which is obviously very important to these lithium-ion batteries, lithium is common. It's right after hydrogen on the periodic table of the elements. Right? There is no shortage of lithium in the world. In fact, before this started, the world's big producer, SQM, it was getting so much lithium out of its salt brines, you know, down there in South America, it was pumping it back into the ground because it was really after the potassium, and the lithium was sort of a byproduct. Tons of lithium in the world. So I'm not saying that there can't be periodic supply crunches in lithium, and we've benefited from those before. But I am saying that even a vastly increased demand for lithium going forward does not necessarily make for a supply crunch. On the other hand, you have other metals that are already looking at supply deficits. And nickel is one of my favorite that I think you mentioned. Copper is also looking at structural supply issues, maybe not immediately, certainly not, you know, with the global economy where it is today. But going forward, there are long-term supply issues in the copper space. And both of these are absolutely essential for this new energy paradigm. Depending on what happens with the DRC, I think cobalt is also particularly interesting. But the lowest risk ways to play this whole big picture, in my mind, are nickel and copper. But I'm not, as you pointed out, buying any nickel or copper plays today. Why? Well, you know, the global economy is in recession, if not depression. And okay, the COVID situation is a one-off. It passes. We don't know yet if there's a second wave in the fall or even starting now with the reopenings. And by the way, I don't want to get into the medical issue here. If you don't believe the COVID germ is that dangerous, you may be right. I'm not making a medical case here. But given the way politics works, if there's a second wave, the governments are going to shut down again. And that has economic consequences, regardless of what you think about the bug, the germ. So, but let's assume that even that doesn't happen. There's no second wave. The economic harm from what's been done already is serious, and it's not something you can snap back from. And arguably, you know, it could take years just from the way things are for the global economy to get back and for demand for industrial minerals to return and exceed pre-COVID levels. What I'm saying here, to be clear, is I'm very bullish on the industrial minerals that are necessary for the new energy paradigm and are in short supply, two qualifiers. But I'm not buying them today because I think there's a very good chance that I'll be able to buy them cheaper in the months ahead, and it's probably going to be a year or years before we really see those trends take off. So I don't want to front run that. I don't want to have money parked in stocks that are going nowhere for a year or two. I want to bet on that trend when it's in action. I don't want inevitable, and I don't want imminent. I want happening now on that trend. That's when I'll be investing.
Excellent, Lobo. I think that's a great place to wrap up our interview. Why don't you share with our listeners where we can find you?
Well, thank you very much for that freebie. The URL, the website, is independentspeculator.com. And again, you can sign up when you go there to our free weekly digest, which does not sign you up for a flood of advertisements. It signs you up for a weekly digest that makes sure you don't miss any of the free articles I publish on all of these topics. There's also a search tool, a little magnifying glass in the upper right of the website. You can click on that, type in PPSS, or type in takeovers, or type in private placements. You'll find all these things we've been talking about. And of course, if you're interested in investing alongside me, I invite you to consider subscribing to my paid services.
Excellent, Lobo. Thanks for all your thoughts.
Thank you, Tom, and have a great one.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?